I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to explore the work of the award-winning Side Effects Public Media Team, which partners with WFYI to provide coverage of important public health issues. This is a recorded program, which means we won't be able to take calls, emails, or questions or comments via social media. My guests are Managing Editor Carmel Roth and reporters and producers for Side Effects Public Media, Jake Harper, Sarah Fenton, and Emily Foreman. Again, this is a recorded program, so we won't be able to take questions or comments, but we do hope that you enjoy the conversation. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking about the award-winning Side Effects Public Media here on No Limits today. This is a pre-recorded program, so we won't be taking calls, emails, or questions or messages via social media. We do hope you're going to enjoy the conversation. This is part of our continuing conversation about issues of public health. We want to give you a look, an overview, really, at some of the great work that is being done. In this first segment, my guest is the managing editor of Side Effects, Carmel Roth. Carmel, welcome to the program.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Certainly. Well, let's start first by talking about what Side Effects is.
Sure, absolutely. We are WFYI's health news desk. We cover health news. We are also a news service because we make all the stories that we do, we make them available to other news outlets, to other public radio stations, as well as commercial news outlets.
And how did Side Effects get started?
Well, we started with some seed money from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. They were giving out grants to public radio stations to increase their local news coverage. And we were lucky enough to get picked. And the grants were both to increase local coverage, local capacity to do news, and also to encourage collaboration among stations. And so we worked with initially two other stations in the region, and that's grown now to we work with five other stations in the region. And the idea is with a central editor, and that's me, we can produce a good body of stories about public health and health policy, comparing what's happening in our own town and state with other towns and states nearby.
And who are the five partners?
Let's see if I can list them out quickly. starting here in the state, we have a partnership we have a partnership with all the other stations in Indiana. I should add that, so that's kind of addition to the
Indiana
five.
Indiana Public Broadcasting Station.
Yeah, we all collaborate. But directly, we work with a reporter in Evansville at WNIN. That's Sam Horton. We work with Columbus, Ohio's public radio station, WOSU. We work with St. Louis Public Radio. We work with WILL in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois. And who am I forgetting? Our good friends in Columbia, Missouri, which is another college town in Missouri. So, yeah.
And this Side Effects, at least as part of a WFYI enterprise, started in 2014?
Yeah, well, December 2014.
So got in just under the wire.
Just 3 years now, yeah.
And, what was the purpose? What aims did you have for the initiative?
Well, we really developed those as we got started. Again, CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, just wanted to see increased coverage of health. But they left it to us to define that and decide what we really wanted to do. And as we began to look at some of the shared themes amongst the collaborating partners, we realized that public health and health policy were areas that needed more coverage. There's a lot of shared, I guess, amongst our region, community health concerns, high obesity rates, high addiction rates, often middling to poor access to health care. So we started to really dig into those issues.
And you said it was left to you to define. What definition did you ultimately come up with, or is it still a work in progress?
Well, it evolves as we watch things change in our world. But we really want to ask ourselves the big questions. So I even have it written on a whiteboard in my office. Just this very basic question, which is, what is killing people in our community and why? And then the sort of the follow-up to that is, why are some people left out of the life-saving care that's available? I mean, you know, so many illnesses, there actually are medicines for them. But not everybody has equal access to the treatments and medicines that are available. And so we want to ask, why is that? And kind of dig in to what are some of the underlying societal issues that prevent people from being able to stay well and live healthy lives. And some of those are going to be policies from the federal to the state to the local level. Things like how much we tax cigarettes, how well we support low-income housing. These things actually end up all affecting people's health, access to parks, places to exercise. You know, it's surprising when you start digging in, looking for root causes. It's a lot of things. Health is impacted by a lot of things in our world, not just like whether you went to the doctor, although that's really important too. And so we dig into policies, we dig into economic conditions, all the root causes.
Why do you think, and I mean, this is a little bit of an inside ball question, but why do you think it was that to some degree journalists were a little bit late to this discussion, in that, you know, now we know that, depending upon whose estimates you use and how you define it, that healthcare represents anywhere from 15 to 25% of the economy.
Yeah.
But at least in my time as a newspaper reporter and all of that, it was not, if there was a beat, it wasn't one of the higher prestige or higher profile ones now. Clearly, this is a major initiative for WFYI and public media. I guess my question is, what took so long?
Well, I mean, in a way, it's not as sexy as covering health in different ways. So I think a lot of news outlets have a health journalist of some kind who covers personal health. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's good clickbait. You know, everybody wants to read that story on the New York Times says you only have to run 10 minutes a day to be perfectly healthy. And, you know, they're always changing it. Like, they do a new study about how much we all should be jogging, you know, every week practically. You know, micro exercise. It turns out if you just run up a flight of stairs every 5 minutes, you're going to be super healthy. I'm making that one up.
My favorite, like, I remember reading, I think it was, I'm not going to mention the publication, said that for every stair you climb, you add 10 seconds to your life. And I was amazed that no one spotted the logical fallacy there, which is that if you just perpetually stay in the staircase, you will never die.
Yeah, so, I mean, it can sometimes be a little bit absurd, like the study that came out that said, you know, all chocolate is good for you, and don't worry about the sugar you're eating too. But it is an interesting beat. People are interested in all those different tips and tricks that might make them healthier, and I think editors tend to go for those stories because they hope that they'll get the clicks, you know. But in reality, a lot more people might be healthier if we could address some of the not so logical policies that we have that make it really hard to do the things that are healthy for you, you know. And so it's one thing if you have a membership to a great gym, maybe you get enough walking in. But what if you live in a neighborhood that's not safe to walk in? So there's things like that that I think are really in some ways more interesting questions to pursue. But it takes being at a news organization that has a commitment to asking big questions to really fund and support that kind of journalism, which is why, you know, I'm really happy to be at WFYI and have the funding that we've been able to receive and also the support of listeners to keep doing this kind of work.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about the award-winning Side Effects Public Media. More broadly, we're talking about questions of public health and how they should be covered, what we consider public health, and all of that. This is a pre-recorded show, so we're not able to take calls, emails, or questions or comments via social media, but we hope you're enjoying the conversation. We're talking right now with Carmel Roth, who is the managing editor of Side Effects. So the big question is now, you know, what stories, how do you go about choosing the stories that, because health is such a big part of people's lives, how do you go about, even though you've got a fair number of resources, good reporters to work on these things, the resources aren't endless. So how do you choose the stories you want to
Right. You want to pursue. No, that's true. Well, like I said, we do try to kind of almost take a scientific approach to some extent, although certainly journalism isn't a science. But we'll look at data about what illnesses might be on the rise or in our communities, and then what factors that cause them are prominent. And so that's led us obviously to cover the opioid addiction problem. And we covered it a lot over the last 3 years, and would have liked to maybe begin to think about other things. But the problem has just increased. If you look at the most recent overdose statistics, 2016 was quite a bit worse than 2015, and that was the worst year on record before that. So we'll continue to focus on it because it's continuing to take people's lives. We're also really interested in a few of the other big problems like diabetes and obesity, which... I don't have the statistics at the tip of my fingers, but they affect a huge number of people, a really high percentage of Americans, and cost us a lot, too. So we're watching that. And then there were a lot of efforts to change federal health care that didn't completely move forward this year, but there's definitely things happening in Washington that will affect people's access to health insurance. So we're just going to keep an eye on that for sure.
What stories are the most challenging to pursue?
That's a good question. I mean, I think with healthcare, one of the things that's challenging is that it's very, it's kind of an insider game with a lot of acronyms and a lot of really technical terms. And it almost keeps not only journalists, but just regular people from understanding anything about their health coverage because there's so many convoluted terms that are used. A lot of people don't even know like basic things like what's a deductible versus, a copay and all those things. So figuring out how to get into something like that and break it down and make it interesting to listen to on the radio or read, that's often one of our challenges.
Well, these are also fairly complex issues, and radio is a conversational medium. Television is a visual one. How do you approach that complexity and make it fit the medium in which you're working?
Yeah, I mean, there's not one answer, but when we were working on coverage planning for this year, we sat down, we listened to a lot of our favorite stories that we'd done up till then, and we tried to identify the qualities we liked, and the stories we thought worked the best were all ones that really had a character, that had a person whose life had been impacted by whatever policy issue we wanted to discuss. And so, we kind of committed to that, and we even put it in our tagline. Our tagline is public health, personal stories. And so we want to make sure that we do really bring in the voices of the people whose lives are touched by all this work.
Which story that your team has reported so far has been the one that's touched you the most, and why? I know it's like asking you to choose among your children,
yeah.
but still.
It might just be because it was one of the first important ones, and so the firsts always stick with you. So when I got started with this work, really once we got our sea legs, it was early 2015, and that's exactly when Scott County, Indiana, was hit with that HIV outbreak. And Jake Harper, who's one of our health reporters, and he's been here the longest, he went down to Austin and spent some time really getting to know people in that town, and then he did a four-part series that included a man there who had not only been infected with HIV, but it hadn't been discovered in time, so it turned into full-blown AIDS, and he also was struggling with addiction. But during the time that Jake got to know him and reported on him, and we kept listening to all this tape, he went through recovery and came out a happier person, despite this really, really difficult diagnosis. And we worked hard to craft those stories. So we listened to the tape again and again. And so, his voice is still in my head, but it's just particularly moving because he was able to get, some improvement in his life despite what happened, but in a place that's still really in need of solutions and resources 3 years later.
And what stories do you have coming up?
We're going to continue, as I mentioned, continue watching the opioid addiction beat. I guess it's a beat at this point. In particular, we're curious to know how some of the state's recent efforts and upcoming legislation might really affect access to treatment for addiction and for mental health in general. You know, generally, addiction is very often co-occurring with other mental health problems that people don't have good treatment for either. So, you know, if you're trying to help people, you need to address the whole person. And so we'll watch that space. Other laws that might come through, you know, if anything changes in the tobacco policy field in Indiana, we want to keep a close eye on that because tobacco is an underlying cause for so many illnesses, like most of the leading causes of death. And just in general, watching healthcare, access to healthcare.
We are talking about the award-winning Side Effects Public Media today on No Limits. This is a recorded program, so we're not able to take calls, emails, or messages via social media. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're continuing our conversation about Side Effects Public Media and, more broadly, the question of public health itself. We are joined in this segment by three Side Effects reporters. They are, and producers, Jake Harper, Sarah Fentum, and Emily Foreman. Welcome, all of you.
Hello. Hi. Hey, thanks.
It's good to have you here. And I should remind our audience that this is a pre-recorded show, which means we're not able to take calls, emails, or questions or comments via social media. But we hope you're enjoying the conversation. So, Jake, I'm going to start with you. Tell me a little bit about how you came to Side Effects and what your areas of interest are.
Ooh, okay. So I started with Side Effects before it was even Side Effects, actually. I started working at the station 3 years ago after sort of very little radio experience. I had done some work at a community station in Madison, Wisconsin, and they looked at my clips here and decided to hire me. And I've always been sort of a science nerd, but that's actually not really what we end up reporting on here most of the time, which is kind of funny. So the policy stuff is kind of what's new to me, and but I like it, and I like reporting on. I mean, we end up reporting on public health and policy issues and places where people are not getting the kind of health care they need, and yeah, I don't know. I've just been sucked in continually since I started.
So what areas generally do you cover for Side Effects?
So I report on addiction primarily. Addiction and Medicaid, I would say, are my main two coverage areas. So I've been covering the opioid epidemic ever since the HIV outbreak in Austin, which was announced in the early 2015. And then I've also done a fair amount of coverage of Indiana's Medicaid expansion program called HIP 2.0.
Okay. Sarah, you, same question.
Yeah, my name is Sarah Fentum, and before I got to WFYI and Side Effects, I worked all over the state. So I worked at WFIU in Bloomington, and then I went up to the Purdue station where I covered health there. And then finally, I made my way down to Side Effects this spring, which was really exciting because I remember when Side Effects first started reading Jake's reporting on Scott County and also HIP 2.0. There were two big public health stories coming out of Indiana at the same time, and Side Effects really led that coverage. And so it was really exciting for me to finally work with everybody here because I had been like a fan for so long. And so what I do here is I also report, and then I work as a producer, and I manage their website and do lots of different helpful things for Side Effects.
What areas do you cover primarily?
So I also cover Medicaid and addiction a lot because, again, they're two of the biggest stories in Indiana, and there's always really interesting, unique things happening here. I do a lot of stuff with the private insurance market, which is, you know, the insurance exchange, individual insurance, that kind of thing. And so so it's been a busy season, and then just kind of picking up whatever anybody needs.
And what drew you to health reporting in the first place?
Because
you'd done it even before you came here.
I got drafted. Okay. So when I was working at WBAA up in West Lafayette, they said, oh, hey, do you want to be a health reporter? And I figured I didn't really have a choice. And so I originally didn't really want to. And then as I kind of did it more and sort of saw it was more like how to, you know, avoid having a cold this season, it's really interesting. And, you know, because it intertwines public health. You take into account poverty and you take into account policy and history. And there are so many things that are meshed together with that, and it's just a really special beat, and I've come to really, really love it.
Emily, how about you?
Okay, so prior to Side Effects, I was reporting on a 2-year series about youth and gun violence in Milwaukee from Milwaukee Public Radio. It was called Precious Lives. So I think that's where I really got interested in public health, because in order to tell 100 stories over 2 years about gun violence, the only way to kind of stay sane about that was to look at it as a public health issue. I felt that was like a very constructive way to sort of break down why was there so much violence in our city. And you could almost by the end, I was seeing that gun violence looked very much like an infectious disease. It clusters. There are factors leading into what causes someone to pick up a gun and then fire it. And then there's a radiating effect. So you can look at upstream factors, but you can also use violence as a measure for how healthy like a community is and why other communities aren't experiencing the same thing. So that's where my interest in public health started.
Okay. And do you cover areas beyond gun violence while you're here?
I haven't covered any gun violence since I've been here.
You have not?
Okay. I've taken a little bit of a break.
All right. So what areas do you cover since you've been here?
Since I've been here, I did a series on pregnant women in recovery and all the various obstacles that they face. So that is tangential to the opioid epidemic. And I've also been on tobacco since the start of my time here, and a little bit on sexuality health as well.
Okay. And I should emphasize here that all of these, we're going to talk about several of the stories that you've worked on here and how they fit into the strategy of covering public health for Side Effects. But if a taste is not enough for our listeners, where can people, I'll stick with you on this one, Emily, where can people go to listen to all of this work?
Okay, so if you want to listen to our work, you can go to sideeffectspublicmedia.org.
Okay, that is Side Effects Public Media, all
Side Effects Public Media, all one word, yeah. .org.
Great. Right. Well, I'm going to start, I think, Sarah, what story would you like to talk about first, do you think, that our audience would be curious to know about?
So back in September, I'm speaking of taking breaks from your usual coverage, I got to take a break from ACA repeal efforts, which were driving me crazy, and I reported on the so-called Black breastfeeding gap. And so this story was a partnership, and we were working with the Indianapolis Recorder, and so hopefully first of many stories that we'll do together. But I worked with a great reporter there. Her name's Keisha McIntyre, and we did a story on how Black mothers breastfeed at a much lower rate than white mothers. And so there's a 14% gap between the two in Indiana, and that number is even higher nationwide. And so it's interesting because a community history is a big predictor of whether a woman breastfeeds or not. So if your mom or your aunt or your best friend breastfeeds, then you're way more likely to breastfeed. And so the fact that it's not as common in the Black community just sort of perpetuates this problem. And that has a lot of, like, serious health implications for the Black community as a whole.
We have a little bit of your story that we can listen to right now, right?
And we will listen. Spicer, who works with IBBC, is all about being natural. She gave an unmedicated birth to her son at home and says almost as soon as he was born, he started feeding right away.
He literally just army crawled right up to it and just... And he was so ravenous, like he was hungry.
Now she wants to help others learn. Despite her positive experience, Spicer says examples of breastfeeding are sometimes hard to find in the Black community. And experts say community history is a big indicator of whether or not women will breastfeed.
We don't always necessarily see our sisters and aunts breastfeeding, or cousins, or we might not have even been breastfed ourselves.
So that was some reporting from one of my guests today, Sarah Fenton. We're talking about Side Effects Public Media on No Limits today. It is a pre-recorded program, so we're not taking calls, emails, or questions or comments via social media. Sarah, you'd mentioned before we listened to the clip that there was a significant gap between the numbers of Caucasian mothers who breastfeed and African-American mothers. Did your reporting lead you to any conclusions as to why, perhaps, there was that gap?
So this is like intersectionality with the capital I, because you see cultural reasons and historical reasons and economic reasons and institutional reasons. And so, for example, there was a study that came out a couple years ago from the CDC that found mothers who give birth in, I guess, more black neighborhoods were marketed formula, or they weren't taught best breastfeeding practices. And black breastfeeding has kind of an ugly history. And so oftentimes someone told me that black mothers breastfeed.
These are the films.
They often had to breastfeed their white children a lot of times instead of their own children. And it's easy to see why, with a history like that, it wouldn't necessarily be an appealing decision to do that. And so and also just economic reasons. I mean, breastfeeding is a lot more common in affluent white communities because a lot of times women have a freedom to breastfeed at work and they don't have to go back to work right away. And so it was just all of these sort of reasons coming together that makes that double digit gap happen.
Was it difficult to get, it was primarily women you talked to, presumably, was it difficult to get them to talk about this?
No. And so that clip that we heard earlier was from a picnic in Garfield Park here in Indianapolis. And it was the Indiana Black Breastfeeding Coalition picnic. And so they all got together and basically just celebrated breastfeeding. And that's where I found Tawai. And the thing with the IBBC is they're very into building a community and just sort of decreasing the stigma around breastfeeding in the black community. And so they're really, really interested in talking because that's sort of their mission. And so that was kind of a bright point in the story that was sort of a sad history story, was there's this community of women and actually whole families. Like, that was another great thing about the picnic, was you saw fathers and brothers and whole families supporting these women and supporting these babies. And so, no, it was not difficult because that's their whole mission. And they have, like, IBBC has this whole thing called Bosom Buddies, where you're paired up with, like, a friend. And the friend, like, helps you learn how to breastfeed your own baby, and then you pay it forward with another one. And so that's their whole thing, is talking about it and creating more communities about it. They were really excited.
Real quickly, what was the feedback to the story?
The feedback was great. I think that being and pairing up with the Indianapolis Recorder really helped, because that helped us find an audience that we don't usually get to. And so... yeah, and I know that it played on our Side Effects partner stations. And so my dad, who actually lives around St. Louis, heard it in St. Louis. And then my relatives texted me and was like, hey, we heard you on the radio. So that's another cool thing about Side Effects, is that we have partners that help us distribute our stories around the country.
So, Jake, I'm gonna shift to you now.
Okay.
Which story has given you most recently the most satisfaction to report?
So this year I actually did an investigation, which is, I guess some of my stories have been investigative in nature, but this was sort of a big undertaking. And we were looking at the drug company Alkermes, which makes a addiction drug called Vivitrol. And so basically we were looking at what the company was doing to lobby in state houses and across the country.
And we have a little bit of that story that we can play. This is Jake Harper's story on Vivitrol marketing.
These are the films. They also have the pill. Okay. And that's what it looks like. Angel and Nate Turner were trying to quit heroin last year. So they saw a doctor, and he prescribed a drug called Suboxone. Angela said it helped her feel normal.
So you could function?
Yeah, you can function, but you're not high.
But she had to wait to get her prescription filled. It took 3 days for her insurance company to agree to pay for the medication. The wait put her into withdrawals.
Laying in bed, going through cold sweats, hot sweats, diarrhea.
Angela had to take care of her daughter. She was tempted to go back and use.
It's either that or lay there and not being able to get up and feed your kid and do what you're supposed to be doing, you know?
For her husband, Nate, the wait was too much. He used heroin again. If the Turners had been prescribed another drug called Vivitrol, they wouldn't have faced the same delays. But that wasn't the medication their doctor thought they needed. The three FDA-approved addiction medicines work differently for different patients, and addiction experts say they all need to be available. But in many places, options are limited. Alkermes, the company that makes Vivitrol, has lobbied in state houses around the country and Congress to promote its drug. Its lobbyists are pushing for regulations that put other treatments at a disadvantage, and also for laws that explicitly favor Vivitrol.
That was Jake Harper's reporting for Side Effects Public Media about Vivitrol. And again, if you're just joining us, this is a pre-recorded No Limits, which means we're not taking calls, emails, or questions or comments via social media. Jake, let's back up. We probably ought to talk about what Vivitrol is.
Yeah, so addiction treatment is a little bit complicated, but basically there are only three medications that can be used to treat opioid addiction. Vivitrol is one of them, but there are two others. One is called buprenorphine, and the other is called methadone, and both of those are actually long-acting opioids. And so you take them once a day, essentially, and it reduces your cravings and prevents withdrawals and you know, in theory helps you, or not in theory, in practice helps you stabilize and return to normalcy so that you can start working on other issues related to addiction. And so Vivitrol is very different from those two drugs. It's a shot of a drug called naltrexone, and it works for a month, and it prevents opioids from having any effect. It's an opioid blocker. And so those first two drugs, they're stigmatized because people think, oh, you're just replacing heroin with a different kind of opioid, and they sort of fail to recognize that these are helpful to people, whereas they see Vivitrol as a one-size-fits-all solution when it's really not. It can work for the right patients, but it's not really meant for everyone.
And how did you come to report on this story?
Yeah, so back in the beginning of the year, I was basically looking at what was happening in the state house with a lot of legislation that was being put forth. And I noticed after looking at a lot of these bills that were related to opioid addiction, I noticed this phrase that kept popping up, and it was a federal Food and Drug Administration approved long-acting non-addictive medication for the treatment of opioid or alcohol dependence. And so the only drug that fits that description is Vivitrol. And so I was seeing that pop up in various places in legislation. And around the same time, I actually got a tip from someone that someone was pushing this. Someone was lobbying for this. And I dug through the lobbying filings and found out that was a man named Steve McCaffrey.
And give us a real brief overview of who Steve McCaffrey is.
Yeah, so Steve McCaffrey is a local mental health advocate. He's the head of an organization called Mental Health America of Indiana. And he's a pretty influential guy. He's known for being at the State House a lot and working on legislation and working with policymakers. He holds this fundraiser every year that a lot of policymakers attend to support Mental Health America of Indiana. But McCaffrey is also part of a separate lobbying organization called the Third House. It's actually housed in the same building as Mental Health America of Indiana. And it takes on other clients. And so after looking at that lobbying firm, I saw that Alkermes was actually a client of the Third House.
We're getting a little bit close on time on this segment. Real quickly, what was the impact of the story? What happened after it came out?
Yeah, so this was like a national issue. It turned out that this kind of thing was happening in state houses all across the country. And the company was putting out sort of slanted information on these other drugs for addiction at the national level, too. And so one thing that happened is that California Senator Kamala Harris announced that she is investigating the company and what they've been doing.
We are talking about Side Effects Public Media on No Limits today. My guests for this segment are Jake Harper, Sarah Fenton, and Emily Foreman. They're all reporters and producers. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today about the award-winning Side Effects Public Media. More broadly, we're talking about issues of public health. This is a pre-recorded program, so we're not able to take questions or comments by phone, by email, or via social media. Do hope, though, that you are enjoying the conversation. My guests for this segment, as for the last one, are reporter producers for Side Effects Public Media, Jake Harper, Sarah Fentum, and Emily Foreman. Before we went to the break, obviously, we heard stories from Sarah about disparities in breastfeeding rates among African-American and Caucasian communities, and Jake's story about Vivitrol. I want to ask Jake, before we pivot and move to Emily here, what other stories you've been working on?
Currently or just generally in the past?
Yeah, well, whichever your preference is, whichever one you think this audience needs to know about.
Yeah, I guess so. One of the other stories I did this year came immediately after some of this Vivitrol stuff. I think I was anxious to get like a positive story under my belt. And so I looked at this program called Project Point that's being run out of Eskenazi Hospital here in Indianapolis. It basically works to connect people to addiction treatment after they've suffered an overdose. And it was something that I had read about and was interested in sort of taking a personal look at.
So, and we have a little bit of that story that we can listen to right now. It is about Project Point. We'll listen to Jake's story right now.
The walk's pretty far, man. You up for it?
It's Saturday, and Christopher Hines is taking me on a walk. We cross a bridge over a highway on a street without sidewalks. He's leading me to the place he overdosed earlier this year. It wasn't his first.
No, I overdosed, I want to say four times. I think it was five in a three-month period.
But he hopes it was his last. That morning, Hines woke up early, sick from withdrawals. So he set out to buy some heroin. He says there was snow on the ground. His hands were numb, his feet were soaked. But he didn't care.
You don't think about nothing but getting it when you're sick like that.
So that was Jake Harper's story on Project Point. What was it about that story that resonated so powerfully with you, Jake?
I mean, I think, like I said, part of it was, I think, because I was coming out of working on these two very serious stories. But then this one was, Christopher was a very good talker. He was very open with me about, you know, what he had struggled with in the past with his addiction and his criminal history, and he was open to going on a walk with me to go see the place where he overdosed for the last time. And you know, when we all of us, I think, have experienced this, but when we report on addiction, we find you know, people that we interview sometimes sort of drop off the map, and they go back to using, and they don't continue with their treatment, at least for a period of time, until they're ready to go back. And what I found with Christopher was that he had done some of that already, but this overdose really was the last time that it was the last time he overdosed. He has relapsed a couple of times, but that overdose sort of became a turning point for him. And at least so far, you know, he's maintained being in treatment for several months now. He's gotten married, he's living in a new location, and his life has just gotten a lot better, and it sort of started with that last overdose that I basically got him to retell.
I'm going to ask all three of you this a bit before we kind of pivot. I mean, what you're talking about here is pretty intimate stuff. Sarah, your story was pretty intimate, I know, from looking at it. Emily, you've talked with some people about very, you know, people at times have this perception that reporters, journalists, are like robots. What's it like? Jake was alluding to the kinds of relationships he has with some of the sources and the people he covers. You know, how do you negotiate that rather tricky ethical area? I'll start with Jake, but I don't want to hear Sarah, and then I'll come to Emily.
I mean,
because it's hard not to care about these people.
Yeah, you want to see, I think in general, like, you want to see people succeed when they start down this path of getting into recovery. I mean, you want that for, it would be inhumane to want something else for people, I think. But you kind of, I mean, you cover these people like you would anyone else. I mean, I find myself with most of the stories that I do, I have to keep following, checking in with people and making sure that, you know, the situation hasn't changed. But it's not really any different than anything else. I think in general, everyone wants a better life for everyone else. I don't think that that's like a ethical issue necessarily.
Sarah?
Well, I'm just incredibly thankful to people that are that open with their lives. And so I think the best way you can honor that is by telling their story as truthfully as you can and giving them sort of enough space to tell their truth and then trying to tell it as accurately as possible. Because you don't want to just go in and get your sound clip and get out. I think understanding people is a way to respect them and while still kind of maintaining a journalistic distance.
Emily.
So are you just asking, like, how to be a human?
Well, no, because there are, you know, at some level, you know, as someone who's been reporting for sadly, more years than I think all of you have been alive, you know, part of what interviewing and covering people involves is creating these relationships that resemble intimacy, but they really aren't, you know, friendship, because you have different sets of obligations. Your first obligation is to your audience when you are a journalist and to the truth, as Sarah points out, which means if, you know, a friend tells you something that makes the friend look bad, you're under no obligation to say that. If a source tells you something and it serves the story, you have some obligation to reveal that.
Right. I think respect is really important in making sure that your subjects and has buy-in. Like, I let them, I kind of pitch it as a collaborative process. I don't know if that's okay, but I try to be as transparent as possible, especially with the more intimate moments. You're usually talking to a person. There's maybe a different set of sort of approach if you're talking to a politician. But you're talking, if someone's invited you into their home and into their personal story, like, you know, you just can't help but be, I don't know, drawn into it. And I mean, that's the whole reason why I do this. I do it for those experiences. So I have the opportunity to allow myself and my views to be shaped by someone's personal experience. And that kind of informs like how I question and how I connect with people. So I'm in it for that relationship.
Emily can connect with sources in a way that I've never seen before. Like, she gets just the most amazing stories out of people, and they trust her almost immediately. And it's so apparent in her stories, and everyone should go and read her stories right now, because you can tell just by reading them.
Well, and I was going to lead us back to that queue at some point anyway, but might as well give them the URL one more time.
That wasn't what I was trying to do.
I know, but it works. It works. It works organically. It is.
If you want to go to read all of our stories, including Emily's, you can go to sideeffectspublicmedia.org.
And referring to your stories, Emily, which of the ones would you like to focus on?
Okay, let's start with the last feature that I did. I wanted to do something about how HIV rates have been going down steadily for several years, but not for the Black and Latinx, gay and bi community. They continue to be disproportionately affected. And services are just not meeting the need. They tend to be oriented towards injection drug users and straight people. And if we don't intervene, we're on a track. The CDC reported this, that we're on a track. They project that half of Black, gay, and bi men will get it in their lifetime, unless we step up prevention efforts. So I heard about this local grassroots effort happening within the ballroom community. And if you don't know what the ballroom community is or ballroom culture, just go watch Paris is Burning right now. Mm-hmm. And it's something, it's really an anchor. It's been an anchor for the gay, Black and Latinx communities for decades. It started in Harlem in the early 80s. And it's really the best way to picture it. It's like a giant catwalk where everyone is competing in a different category. There's walking, there's strutting, there's dancing, and it's this incredible athletic feat. There's drag, there isn't drag. And it's just this giant celebration. So let's listen to the clip.
Yeah, we'll listen to a piece of your story.
It is an athletic sight to see. Bronson Rowley was 19 years old when he first found a home in the ballroom scene.
When I came out to my mother, it was like a hard time between me and her. So it was like when I was at home, I couldn't be myself. So that was my way to go and be around other people like me and express myself and be just as gay as I wanted to be. And then I'll come home and, you know, transform back into this son that my mother wanted me to be. So.
The Red Ribbon Rumble is a ball that happens every first Friday of the month in Indianapolis. The party gets going just before midnight at a rec center.
When I think about runway, there's only one, my son, the Ronson. Well, it's
at the ball, Rowley goes by Ronson Balenciaga, inspired by the luxury shoe designer.
It's runway.
His event is Runway, so when the MC calls his name, Ronson struts up and down the floor in a black t-shirt and jeans. In the past, he's worn S&M and haute couture-inspired looks, like a birdcage headpiece, fishnets, and a whip. He's not just here to walk. He's here to teach people about HIV.
And that was a piece of Emily Foreman's story on the Ronson Rally at a ball. What drew you to that story?
Yeah, so Ronson, so the ballroom community is a really tight-knit community. It's almost like a surrogate family for a lot of people. And Ronson is, he's influential within the Indianapolis ballroom community. He is a legend in his category. He's one of the best runway walkers in this region. I think that includes Ohio, Indianapolis, and Indiana, and one other state. But I thought it was a really innovative idea what Brothers United, that's a group that throws these balls, was doing, was they enlisted Ronson to really teach and educate about HIV and STI prevention. So what they're doing is they're training leaders like Ronson in the ballroom community to just know like how what you can do to protect yourself. And so naturally what happens, because he's so such a incremental part of it, he's spreading education all the time amongst his peers. And one of those points that is missed a lot is there's a medication called PrEP. It's preventative. It's called pre-exposure prophylaxis. Sorry, did I say that right? And a lot of people don't know about it, but it's a pill that you can take to protect yourself from getting HIV. And a lot of people, specifically in the Black community, aren't getting on PrEP. And experts say there are a lot of different reasons for that. Some has to do with access to care, healthcare issues. Some doctors themselves aren't even educated. I mean, Ronson was telling me that he just learned about PrEP when he became ambassador in the ballroom community. His doctor never mentioned it to him, but he's someone who could really benefit from being on PrEP. So I wanted to, carry these really important pieces of information in a very, like, active scene and a very personal story.
And we've got time for perhaps one more of your stories. Which one would you like to focus on?
We can do the next on the list. Let's see. We can do the pregnant in recovery story.
Should we listen to a little bit of that first?
Sure, let's just play
it. Why don't we listen to the clip? Yeah.
I gotta get the address. because I'm already late.
26-year-old Tia Hostler wakes up at 7:35 a.m. on a friend's couch next to her newborn son's crib.
Hi, buddy.
She babysits her friend's three girls while their mom works overnight. Tia slept through her alarm, and now she's in a rush to make her group therapy appointment. She ties her Kool-Aid red hair into a tight bun and kisses her two-month-old son, Marshawn.
Bye, Booger. I love you, Booger.
Marshawn will stay with his dad, Tia's boyfriend, while she's in group therapy. It's her first day back since giving birth.
It's always a struggle for me to get out of the house. What?
Her boyfriend calls out after her with a question.
Green! See, I gotta tell everybody what color their toothbrush is.
Every day, Tia juggles bus schedules, doctor's appointments, random drug testing, and job hunting. She doesn't want to give Child Protective Services any reason to investigate, like what happened with her daughter a year ago.
I just bonded with her inside of me. Like, I just knew we were really close. When they took her, it's like they ripped my heart out of my chest. It was really hard, especially when I was doing everything necessary to not lose her, prevent from losing her.
And that was Emily Foreman's story on moms and addiction help. You talk about what drew you to that story.
Yeah, what drew me, this was part of a three-part series, but what drew me to this was it's incredibly hard for pregnant women in recovery to stay in recovery and find doctors that will treat them. And this was, Tia just really exemplifies for me like how hard it is to stay in recovery and how many buses you have to take. So, and she found a place that would help her. So I wanted people to know what a day in the life was like of a mom who's a new mom who's prioritizing her recovery.
We're getting close on time here, so I want to ask each of you with about 20 seconds, what are you working on now? What can we look forward to in the coming days? I'll start with Emily.
Oh, that's a good. Okay, so we are going to be launching a podcast about healthcare workarounds. So if you have any ideas for us, please call or email somehow.
So who should they email? How should they
me? Okay. I'm eForeman@WFYI.org.
Okay.
Or any of us. It's our first initial last name at WFYI.org. So collectively, we're working on a podcast about healthcare workarounds.
Okay, and Sarah?
You can also find us at Side Effects News, both on Facebook and Twitter. I got to do my social media
do
hat.
Do the social media and push that.
Yeah.
Jake, what are you working on?
More addiction stories, really.
all addiction all the
we
time,
love addiction.
Pretty
yeah,
much.
Pretty much.
And do you see that for the foreseeable future?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, it's not going away. So,
if anything, it's getting worse.
Yeah.
Well, that will have to be the last word. I'd like to thank all of you. I'd like to thank first your managing editor, Carmel Roth, who joined us for the first segment, and then for these segments, reporters, producers for Side Effects Public Media, Jake Harper, Sarah Fentum, and Emily Foreman. Also, like to thank our listeners for taking part in the conversation. Remind everyone that they can see more of these stories at sideeffectspublicmedia.org. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.